headlines. Iran's leader calls for an end to the war in Ukraine, saying the country is the victim of the U.S. policy of creating crises. Russia says it sees, quote, no desire on the part of Ukraine to try to find a legitimate and balanced solution to the problems between the two countries. And as a global outcry over the brutal treatment of indigenous people in Canada is still fresh, 169 new potential graves are found at the site of a former residential school. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to World News. Now, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called for an end to the war in Ukraine and singled out the U.S. and its policies as the main culprit for the crisis.
در صورتی ممکنه که ریشه بحران شناخته بشه ریشه بحران در اوکراین سیاست‌های آمریکاست سیاست‌های غربی هست اینها ریشه بحرانه اینها رو باید شناخت و بر اساس اینها قضاوت کرد داوری کرد و اگر اهل اقدام بودیم اقدام کرد
آیت‌الله سید علی خامنه‌ای noted that the US feeds on crises and makes around the world. He said Western powers cannot be trusted and their support for their puppet regimes is nothing but a mirage. He recalled how the Ukrainian president and former Afghan president both acknowledged being abandoned by Washington. Ayatollah Khamenei called the U.S. government a mafia regime, saying Western nations use science to slaughter and plunder other nations. He said Washington is a perfect example and manifestation of modern ignorance. Leader was delivering a speech on the occasion of Eid al-Mapas, the day the Holy Prophet Muhammad was chosen as God's messenger. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement warns ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine could have serious repercussions globally. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that Moscow-Kiev tensions are very dangerous. He believes conflict is more than just a face-off between Russia and Ukraine and has the potential to draw in the rest of the world. Lebanese resistance chief also blasted the West for its double standard approach toward Russia. He questioned the role of the international community at a time when the U.S. is waging wars against Iraq and Afghanistan. Nasrallah said that Washington is responsible for what's happening in Ukraine and that the Ukrainian people are the ones who are paying the price for this conflict. Russia's military operation in Ukraine is now in its seventh day, with major cities including the capital Kiev being targets of attacks. An airstrike on Kiev's main television tower killed five people and knocked out some state broadcasting. Satellite images show Russian tanks and armored vehicles moving toward the city. Convoy stretches for more than 65 kilometers. In the Black Sea city of Kherson, the Russian army has set up checkpoints. Meanwhile, in Kharkiv, a central square was shelled by advancing Russian forces. Ukraine's emergency services say the attack left 10 people dead. Eight others were also killed in an airstrike on a housing block in the city. Meanwhile, Russia's defense minister has vowed to push ahead with the operation until Moscow's objectives are achieved. Moscow accuses Kiev of not showing any desire to find a legitimate and balanced solution to the ongoing conflict. And Russia's ambassador to the UN in Geneva says his country supports equality and respect-based diplomacy, but does not see the same approach from Kiev. Meanwhile, Ukraine's president has told his U.S. counterpart that we must stop the aggressor as soon as possible. Vladimir Zelensky has called on NATO to impose a no-fly zone over Ukraine, but the alliance has rejected the request. Zelensky says his country will demand legally binding security guarantees if NATO rules out the possibility of Kiev joining the organization. He also says Russia needs to stop bombing the country's cities before any meaningful talks on a ceasefire can start. Western countries are piling up pressure on Russia as Moscow pushes ahead with its military operation in Ukraine. The West has sought to cripple Russia's banking sector with a barrage of sanctions. In one of the latest measures, the European Union banned selected Russian banks from the SWIFT global payment system. The sanctions have led Russia's national currency to hit record lows against the dollar. In response, the Russian government has ordered emergency capital controls, including a ban on cash exports of foreign currency exceeding $10,000 in value. EU has also banned Russian state media outlets RT and Sputnik from broadcasting in the bloc. The European Council says sanctions against Moscow have been massive and unprecedented.
We have responded with massive and unprecedented sanctions. We imposed sanctions on political and military leaders, on oligarchs, on Vladimir Putin, on Sergei Lavrov. We are also taking powerful measures to severely restrict the use of the foreign currency reserve of the Russian Central Bank. We are excluding key Russian banks from the SWIFT system. And we are also imposing severe sanctions on key sectors of Russia's economy.
The West sanctions have also targeted Russia's energy sector. Britain and Canada have barred Russia-linked vessels from entering their ports. UK has also warned that removing Russia as one of five permanent members of the UN Security Council is among options on the table. More than a dozen European countries, as well as Canada, have also closed their airspace to Russia. In retaliation, Russia has shut off all 27 EU nations, as well as Britain and Canada, from its airspace. US has also expelled a dozen Russian diplomats in the country's UN mission. Russia has vowed to retaliate, saying it will not yield to sanctions and pressure. This comes as the UN's International Court of Justice says it will hold public hearings early next week over a lawsuit filed by Ukraine seeking a halt to Moscow's offensive. Meanwhile, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank say they are racing to provide billions of dollars of additional funding to Ukraine in the coming weeks. News review program where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Now, Israeli forces killed a third Palestinian in the West Bank in less than 24 hours as tensions run high in occupied territories. Amar Shafiq Abu Afifa was shot dead near the city of Bethlehem. Israeli forces are refusing to hand over his body to Palestinians. Earlier in the day, Israeli forces killed two other Palestinians in a raid on the Jenin refugee camp. Tuesday was declared a day of rage in Palestine, with demonstrations held across the occupied West Bank in solidarity with prisoners languishing in Israeli jails. Protests were held in Ramallah, Tulkarm, and Bethlehem, among other cities and towns. Israeli forces clashed with demonstrators in Al-Khalil and Beit Umar.
Palestinians in the occupied Ramallah took to the streets in support of more than 4,500 prisoners who are facing strict punitive measures and collective punishment by Israeli prison authorities. Recently, the prisoners have taken a series of actions against new restrictions imposed on them by Israeli authorities. Prisoners' advocacy groups who organized the protest described the prisoners' actions as an uprising or intifada.
I prefer to call it the prisoners' intifada or uprising because the inmates face daily assault caused by the prison administration, who is seeking to destroy their collective efforts over the years that aim to improve living conditions in detention.
Tensions in Israeli prisons have escalated since September 2021, following the escape of six prisoners from the Gilboa High Security Jail. Although they were caught after a massive manhunt, Israeli officials implemented several punitive measures against the remaining detainees, such as banning visits and reducing their yard time, which led to clashes and strikes.
The prisoners are our red line. We will not allow prison authorities to cross it, and we will not remain silent on these punitive measures against our freedom fighters. And we know at the end of the day they will achieve victory as they did in previous battles. The prison administration knows very well what it's doing will only lead to more tension.
As part of those actions taken by the prisoners since January the 1st, some 500 detainees have been boycotting the Israeli military court system to protest their imprisonment under the so-called administrative detention. Today, some 4,500 Palestinians are held in Israeli prisons, including 180 children and 34 women. Palestinians hail them as freedom fighters.
Prisoners' advocacy groups say 2022 has been worse for the Palestinian prisoners so far, and the inmates themselves believe that they are in need of such solidarity protests because the worst is yet to come in the wake of the escalating tough measures by the Israeli prison authorities. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Joining us now for the program is Robert Fantina, author and journalist from Kitchener, Ontario, and Lawrence Davison, former lecturer out of Westchester University, joining us from Westchester, Pennsylvania. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess, Lawrence Davison, we'll start with you. Hope you're safe and doing well. Now, Israeli forces have killed three Palestinian protesters over the last day. My question to you, we don't hear anything about it out of the international community. We don't hear about the guy with the big guns taking advantage of the guy with little guns or no guns taking his land, but we hear an awful lot about Russia with the big guns going in against a beleaguered military there in the Ukrainian army, and everybody's hearts are supposed to pour out for, Ukrainians. Why not Palestinians?
Yeah, well, it's a very good question. There was a host on one of the programs of MSNBC who actually came out on the air and said that American credibility in this case is not very good because of the hypocrisy, one of which, of course, is that we support, the taking of land as long as the people who are taking it as our allies. When it comes to the shootings, I think it's very important to understand that these shootings are not just individual soldiers acting out, but these shootings essentially are policy. The soldiers know that they can't, that they're not going to be punished. And so what we've got here is a unwritten yet official policy that if you think that you can get a good shot at a Palestinian demonstrator, you take it. It's not only an unwritten but official policy of the army, but it's a publicly supported policy too. I think that the bulk of the Israeli, the Jewish Israeli population doesn't care. I mean, so these guys can shoot anybody they want, and they're sort of semi-heroes. And it's also the case that not only does the Israeli public not care, but the Western political, political establishment doesn't care. And that's why this will go on forever. I mean, not forever, but indefinitely.
Robert Fantina, welcome to the program. Why is that? The Western politicians really don't care about Palestinians. I mean, the value of a human life in the eyes of the Western world, is it defined by what? Geography, by race, by religion, by according to Larry, allied support? What's going on here?
There are a few issues. One, of course, is that Western powers, especially the United States, will allow their allies to do whatever they want to, regardless of how many international laws it violates, how many crimes against humanity are committed, and regardless of the abominable repression of human rights. Part of the thing we see that's different between the Russian bombardment of the Ukraine and Israel's ongoing repression of the Palestinians is that the Palestinians are mainly Muslims. It's mainly a Muslim nation, and there is a tremendous amount of prejudice against Muslims in the United States and other Western countries as well. They're seen as somehow not of the same value as whites of European descent. So we have in the Ukraine, which has a small but not a significant Muslim population, and so the people there that are being bombed and shot, this is a horrible thing. when those same things happen to Palestinians, well, it's Israel defending itself. I don't know why the U.S. government isn't justifying Russia's actions by saying Russia is defending itself. It's similar, although it's more extreme in the situation with Israel and Palestine, because the Palestinian people have every right under international law to resist. You mentioned earlier the fact that more punitive measures have been taken against prisoners since the breakout of several prisoners a few months ago. This is collective punishment, violation of international law, but the Western governments aren't saying anything about it. There's been a lot of publicity about some six-year-old girl who was killed in Ukraine. Terrible, horrible, and tragic event. But children are killed in Palestine on a regular basis. We don't hear about it. So there is a lot of, it's partly due to the politics and who countries are allied with. It's partly due to religion, certainly, and ethnicity. But it's, no matter what it's attributed to, it is completely unfair and unjust.
Thank you, gentlemen. Canada's dark colonial past once again comes to light with the discovery of more unmarked graves of Native children. An Indigenous community has now identified 169 potential unmarked graves at another former residential school site northwest of Edmonton. The discovery brings a total number of such graves found so far to more than 1,500. Country's authorities forcibly separated Indigenous children from their families during the 19th and 20th centuries to assimilate them into Canadian society. They were taken to residential schools run by the Catholic Church, where they were subjected to physical, sexual, and psychological abuse. The church and the Canadian government have both apologized for the abuses. And that's it for your latest, everyone, and bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The handling of the Kabul strike is an ominous sign that while Biden has pledged to review the drone program, a long-standing mechanism for self-exoneration remains entrenched. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jeremy Schill Ryder. This article is published under the heading The Mysterious Case of Joe Biden and the Future of Drone Wars. Stay tuned for more. At least two of the U.S. airstrikes conducted under Biden have killed civilians, including the now infamous August 29th attack in Kabul, Afghanistan, that killed 10 civilians, seven of them children. While Biden's drone strike data set is tiny, the outcome of his known strikes presents a ghastly civilian death rate. In the case of Afghanistan hit, 100% of the victims were civilians. So what is happening? Why has Biden apparently decided to pump the brakes on a two-law war that he and President Barack Obama embraced so enthusiastically? For a year, the Biden administration has been engaged in a comprehensive review of the use of drone strikes as a part of a broader evaluation of counterterrorism policy that is expected to be completed later this year or at some point in early 2022. I think the White House is appropriately wary about drone strikes, said Rosa Brooks, a former Obama administration official who worked for the Pentagon as counselor to the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy from 2009 to 2011. My sense is that they're serious about the review and are trying to minimize drone strikes, at least until there is complete clarity on internal policies, she added. Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, did away with most of the rules the Obama administration had crafted in what Obama characterized as an effort to increase transparency, reduce civilian deaths, and establish guidelines that could give some sense of legitimacy to what was, in reality, an assassination program. Biden could have stopped at rescinding Trump's reversals and then resumed the course of regular drone strikes according to the rules developed primarily in Obama's second term. But he didn't. Instead, on the day of Biden's inauguration, his national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, quietly issued an order to roll back Trump's loosening of rules surrounding drone strikes, specifically one that bestowed on military commanders the power to authorize such strikes in undeclared war zones like Somalia and Yemen without direct permission from the White House. The Biden administration has not yet indicated whether it will revert the Obama-era guidance for strikes or craft a new policy with more robust rules, particularly surrounding the issue of civilian death. Across almost all active U.S. conflicts, we have seen a sharp fall in declared U.S. military actions under Biden, including by drone in Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Yemen, and Libya, said Chris Woods, director of the British non-governmental organization Air Wars, which tracks U.S. airstrikes and civilian deaths in many nations where the United States is engaged militarily. Woods notes that the strikes were already declining in the latter half of Trump's presidency and that Biden's early moratorium on strikes and his decision thus far to limit their use have greatly reduced civilian deaths at the hands of U.S. forces in several countries. What we don't know yet is if these trends will sustain. Publicly, the administration has yet to articulate its strategy, he said. Privately, we are hearing of the emergence of a hybrid Trump-Obama approach, which, if true, could mean less protections in place for civilians than during the latter part of Obama. That's a worry. Spokesperson for the National Security Council did not respond to requests for comment. For years, a core group of mostly progressive members of Congress have steadily sought to find legislative solutions to the excessive secrecy surrounding drone strikes and to make laws requiring more transparency from the Pentagon on civilian casualties. These efforts, which began during Obama's tenure, intensified under Trump, who made clear that he did not care about civilian deaths and, on the campaign trail in 2016, actively encouraged the killing of families of suspected terrorists. territories. They were also a response to a renewed surge beginning in 2018 in civilian deaths in Afghanistan. In 2019, the National Defense Authorization Act established a requirement that a senior civilian within the Department of Defense be empowered to develop, coordinate, and oversee compliance with the policy of the department relating to civilian casualties resulting from United States military operations. Among the duties of this officer would be to develop and disseminate best practices for reducing civilian deaths, to establish a public internet-based mechanism for people to submit allegations of civilian harm, to ensure that standardized policies were in place for the Pentagon to acknowledge responsibility for deaths caused by U.S. military operations, and to decide whether to give ex gratia payments to the families of civilians killed as well as to those injured by U.S. operations. The Trump administration has slow-rolled the system's creation and never effectively implemented it. Even before taking office, the Biden campaign had pledged to review the use of drone strikes as part of his counterterrorism approach. Miriam Benjamin, co-founder of the activist group Code Pink, who has regularly traveled to countries targeted in drone strikes, said drones in particular are an inherently indiscriminate weapon. They have no place in our world. The U.S. should discontinue the use of armed drones and work through the UN for a multilateral treaty to banish them from the face of the earth, in full recognition of U.S. responsibility for unleashing this terror on humanity. There is a campaign to abolish autonomous weapons, but this doesn't go far enough. All drone warfare should be banned. At a minimum, Benjamin said, the Biden administration should immediately restart publishing the monthly air power summaries discontinued by Trump and, in fact, expand them from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria to include all U.S. weapons releases in all countries. They should also be more comprehensive to include all types of aircraft, including helicopters, all branches of the U.S. military and the CIA and other agencies. While Benjamin and other activists have consistently focused on drones, they also recognize that drone strikes represent a small number of total U.S. airstrikes. She points to the latest statistics from Air Wars, which indicate that since Biden took office, there have been 25 U.S. airstrikes in Iraq and 14 in Syria, most of them conducted by conventional aircraft, not drones. In Somalia, according to Air Wars, Biden's 16 strikes to date have already outpaced Obama's average 7.5 per year, though they lag far behind Trump's annual average of 69. Benjamin asserted, so Biden already seems to be conducting twice as many strikes as Obama did in that country, a pattern that very likely holds in other parts of Africa too.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all around the world, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer doubts and misconceptions from around the world on Islamic issues and Islamic principles. Like always, in our recent shows, we have invited Sheikh Nur Muhammad from Qom Seminary Schools. We'd like to welcome him to this show and say salam to him and inshallah start our discussion with him. Sheikhana, salam alaikum.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. It's a great pleasure for us. The question of the day is about istikhara or khira, what is known as khira in Islamic communities. We want to ask the respected guest, the speaker of the show, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, about this concept and issue. First of all, we want you, Sheikh, to tell us what does istikhara mean exactly, or what does khira mean? Is it documented in Islamic traditions and Islamic hadith? And then in case we refer to the istikhara or khira, are we allowed to act upon that? Or no, it's just a sort of suggestion. First, so we want to see if it has, principally, it has any place in Islamic teachings, then in case we deal with it and in case we refer to it, are we allowed to act upon that or not?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for this valid question. It is one of the questions that frequently have been asked from different scholars, that whether we have istikhara, which literally translated to be asked goodness from, for example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, or some people do it by rosary and so on and so forth.
So what does it mean exactly, Sheikh, when they do or perform istikhara? What is it like?
Let me check it by the verse of Noble Quran, whether we have khira or istikhara, because we have different terms used by different people here or not. For example, we have in one narration from Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, he said that, إِذَا أَرَادَ أَحَدُكُمْ أَمْرًا فَلَا يُشَاوِرْ فِيهِ أَحَدًا مِنَ النَّاسِ حَتَّى يُشَاوِرَ اللَّهُ عَزَّ وَجَلَّ. If you want to, if you decide to do something, first of all, to have some kind of consultation with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala before doing everything and before having any action. He said that, وَمَا مُشَاوِرَةُ اللَّهُ عَزَّ وَجَلَّ. How can I consult with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? قال يبدا فيستخير الله عز وجل اولا ثم يشاور فيه. He said that first of all, to have kind of prayer, let me translate it in this way, to have kind of prayer and supplication with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then he can go and consult with anybody. Of course, that individual should be wise, trustful person and reliable one. فَإِنَّهُ إِذَا بَدَأَ بِاللَّهِ أَجْرَ اللَّهَ لَهُ الْخَيْرِ أَلَى لِسَانِ مَنْ شَاءَ مِنَ الْخَيْرِ مِنَ الْخَلْقِ. He said that if you start your consultation with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then go to other people, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala put goodness into the tongue of that individual, and you can, that individual can guide you to the right path. So let me come back to the beginning of this beautiful narration. How can I consult with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Consultation with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala means to ask, to have some kind of prayer with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and ask him to have kind of assistance, you know, to you. In the sometimes Ahlul Bayt ask us to tell, for example, 100 times.
Yeah.
Sometimes it depends on your what you want to do. Okay, it depends on your action that you are going to do that. Sometimes for 7 times, sometimes for 3 times, you should have this prayer. Of course, these are some kind of recommendations. Nobody has been obliged to do that. We are not talking about Islamic laws. Just we are talking about some, let's say, spiritual and some kind of recommendation that if you want to start to do anything, for example, you want to start a job, a business, it has some kind of benefit for you or not.
Yeah.
We have some recommendation that you, for example, recite this prayer, and I'm going to mention that prayer, but very briefly, for example, you say that Astaghfirullah birahmati khiyaratan afiyah aw khiyaratan fi afiyah. I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to bestow upon me some kind of goodness with a blessing. and there is no harm, you know, going to me. There is no deficiency, you know, inflicted upon me. And these kind of prayers, of course, these prayers are different. Just I mentioned a brief, you know, quotation of that. For example, we have the prayer of Imam al-Mahdi, many other prayers. Just your connection and asking for some kind of blessing from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and to have some kind of reliance to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and then go to other people, start consulting with other people and seeking consultation. And for example, other process that you are going to do that.
Very true.
It is recommended to do and to, from the beginning, from get-go, to have some kinds of prayer with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and ask Him to help you and to assist you. Right. This is a meaning of istikhara or khira that we have in the narrations of Ahlul Bayt. But let me add, my brother, let me add, we have one or two narrations talking about doing this formula. For example, go to an individual and ask him to do istikhara by rosary or by Noble Quran. We have some two narrations, but some scholars, including, for example, Sheikh At-Tusi, they have some doubts and question about the authenticity of such narrations.
Okay, thank you very much, that much for knowing what the istikhara or khair is. To ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for goodness. So this has different formats. Some refer to take consultation from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala from the language of Al-Quran, the book of God. And some refer to some rosaries and actually, based on some formulas, they reach to know and to interpret what is being understood from that rosary.
Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, inshallah,
inshallah, you'll find your way. So let's ask Sheikh that, so whatever comes out as the result of this consultation from Al-Quran or the rosary, can it be a proof for us to act upon that, Sheikh?
As I said, you know, it depends whether what is your scholarly analysis of the authenticity of istikhara.
Mm-hmm.
But personally, according to my little knowledge that I have, for the most cases, the istikhara that we have in the narrations of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalatu wassalam is istikhara du'a'i, which we call it in Farsi, which means some kind of asking goodness from Allah by or via prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me share another narration.
Yeah.
For example, he said that Imam al-Sadiq, if I'm not mistaken, he said that فَاسْتَخِرِ اللَّهِ مَأَتَ مَرَّ خِيَرَةً فِي آفِيَةً. Before doing anything, ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for goodness 100 times.
Mm-hmm.
فَإِنْ إِهْلَوْلَا فِي قَلْبِكَ بَعْدَ الْإِسْتِخَارَ فَبِئِهَا. After doing that, after doing this supplication or prayer, as I said, 100 times, in other narration we have, for example, 3 times or 7 times. If look at your heart, whether you, whatever it has been reminded, you have been reminded of, you can do that. Mm-hmm. If it is, for example, if it was positive, you go and start that business.
Mm-hmm.
In the narration, for example, to sell something, or if it was negative, you stop doing that. وَاسْتَبْدِلْ غَيْرَهُمَا إِنْ شَاءَ اللَّهُ وَالْتَكُنِ الْإِسْتِخَارَةَ بَعْدَ صَلَاتِكَ رَكْعَتَيْنِ. As I said, in some narration we have that if you do, first of all, you should have 2 units of prayer, mm-hmm. which we call it Salatul Istikhara, or 2 units of the prayer.
Yeah.
After these 2 units, you have some kinds of prayer toward Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Then you know, you can go and you have your consultation with other people. Or, for example, look at your hearts, whatever you're reminded of and whatever occurred in your mind and your heart, you can do and you practice upon that. And what if that prayer, for example, one quotation we have, Allahumma inni as'aluka bi annaka alimul ghaib wa shahada ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa anta allamul ghuyub astaghfirullah bi rahmatih. I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because He is all, you know, knowing, He knows the, you know, the heavens and earth, and he is a most blessing and most merciful, and He knows all hidden things. I ask goodness from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala because of His mercy.
So this is a supplication or prayer, istikhara akhira, that you talked about. Shaykhana, is there any, let's say, hadith or let's say instruction from Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam or the household of the Prophet, and the quality of istikhara in the form of, let's say, the one which is being done with rosary or with Al-Quran, because it is quite common these days, because the kind of istikhara that you talked about and explained from the language of the tradition, it's not that common way of performing istikhara. But the other two forms, that is performing istikhara with rosary and Quran, is more common. So is there any recommendation from Ahlul Bayt in this regard, any instruction how to perform it?
As I said, we have one or two narrations, and maybe three in this regard has been quoted, especially doing some kind of istikhara with the verses of Noble Quran. And for example, Sheikh Abbas al-Qummi, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bless his soul, he mentioned in Mafatihul Janan, his great masterpiece of the collection of the prayers of Ahlul Bayt. He has quoted, and other scholars that have quoted one or two narration with regards to doing istikhara via, for example, verses of Noble Quran. But as I said, some scholars, they have questioned and have some doubts about the authenticity of those narrations. And of course, we do not want to, I want to emphasize on the point that we do not want to refute these kind of istikhara. We do not want to do that. But after all, we have some doubts about the authenticity of such istikhara. But what is sure, for sure, you can understand from the narrations of Ahlul Bayt is the istikhara that I mentioned, and it has two units of prayers, and after that you have prayers to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then you go and start your...
This format is the one which is instructed by the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam.
At least, yes, and all scholars, they believe on the authenticity of this one, this very kind of istikhara.
But not the other forms. Thank you very much, dear Sheikh, for your explanations and enlightenment on this issue of the istikhara. So istikhara by itself, as respected Sheikh explained, whatever it has been recommended by Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam is the one which is known as istikhara dua, that is a supplication or prayer form of istikhara that we perform two rak'ah of prayers, and then after that there is a dua that we need to recite it 100 times, if I'm not mistaken. Then we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for a blessing, for a goodness, and to clarify for us the way, because usually istikharas or khiras are being done at the time that a person is in state of ambiguity or in state of being in doubt to perform an action or not to do it. So then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will tell him directly or indirectly how to what to do with in that specific case that he is afflicted with.
Let me add 100 times for important job that you are going to do that. And 3 times or 7 times has been mentioned in the narration for easy job that you are going to do.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. That was a good complimentary statement from the respected Sheikh. Okay, dear brothers and sisters, but what we understood all in all, istikhara is not being going to be looked as a proof so that we act upon that and we consider it as something 100% certain and there is no way around. So this is not what Islam tells us. Till our next show, I live in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
At the moment, we have no pan-variant vaccine for any endemic virus. Researchers have long dreamed of a universal vaccine that would make flu epidemics less lethal, and there are now promising signs that it could be possible. The design principle for a universal COVID vaccine would follow similar lines. We have prepared for you an article written by Philip Ball. The piece is titled, Will We Get a Single Variant-Proof Vaccine for COVID? Recently, the British government announced additional vaccine booster jabs for the over 75s and suggested a further shot is likely to be needed in the autumn. But imagine if the next COVID vaccine jab you have were the last you would ever need. That's a dream being actively pursued now by researchers who feel it could be possible to make a universal vaccine against the SARS-CoV-2 virus that would work well not only against all existing variants, but any that the virus could plausibly mutate into in the future. Some are thinking even bigger. In January, two experts called for more research into universal coronavirus vaccines that would work not only against SARS-CoV-2, but against the many other coronaviruses in animal populations that have the potential to spill over into humans and cause future pandemics. They wrote in the New England Journal of Medicine, we need a research approach that can characterize the global coronaviral universe in multiple species, adding, and apply this information in developing broadly protective universal vaccines against all coronaviruses. Is that just a fantasy? Not necessarily. Larry Corey, a virologist and vaccine expert at the University of Washington in Seattle, says, after all, many considered it fanciful when the pandemic first began that we've had a vaccine against COVID-19 in less than a year. But experience has proved that as we, as a research community, can pull together and do remarkable things. The current vaccines were developed against the original ancestral variant of SARS-CoV-2. They still work remarkably well against the new variants in preventing severe disease. Larry Corey says that even against the Delta variant, there seems to be about a 90-fold difference in the death rate between vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals. But the Omicron variant has caused alarm by its ability to transmit faster than the others and to infect vaccinated people. Although very few such individuals develop serious symptoms from Omicron, it can actively suppress the immune defenses that vaccination, as well as natural infection, activate. Variants acquire changes to the chemical structure of the viral proteins through random mutations when the virus replicates that give them some comparative advantage, say improved transmissibility. Many of these changes happen on the so-called spike protein, which sticks out of the virus shell and latches on to proteins in the membranes of human cells, creating a point of attachment and attack. Omicron has an alarming number of such mutations, showing how much capacity SARS-CoV-2 has to spring surprises. One answer is to adapt the vaccines to the variants. If, as widely expected, SARS-CoV-2 eventually becomes endemic in the population, constantly circulating at a low level like flu and cold viruses, but with the potential to produce an epidemic outbreak, the vaccines could be tailored to whatever variant are currently in circulation. This is more or less what happens with flu. Each season's flu vaccine is based on a best guess of what the season's strains are likely to be. That's all very well, except that Omicron has shown how rapidly a significantly new variant of the coronavirus can appear and spread globally. Pfizer and Moderna are now working on a vaccine tailored to Omicron. But even if this can be made and tested within a few months, that may be too late. So a universal vaccine that can protect against all the variants could be preferable. Kayvon Mojarred, who leads a team seeking to develop one at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research in Silver Springs, Maryland, says, "We need a vaccine that has potential to protect broadly and proactively against multiple coronavirus species and strains." At the moment, researchers are mostly striving for a relatively modest target of hitting just a subset of the coronavirus universe, typically to stimulate an immune response against a part of the spike protein called the receptor binding domain, or RBD, shared by SARS, SARS-CoV-2, and closely related bat coronaviruses. The receptor binding domain is the part of the spike protein that latches on to the host cells. Although some of the variants have small mutations in their receptor binding domain, its chemical structure doesn't change much. Create a strong immune response to the RBD, the receptor binding domain, and it could work against any virus in this family. Kayvon Mojarred's team began phase 1 clinical trials, looking just at the safety of their pan-variant vaccine in April of 2021. It uses a tiny nanoparticle called ferritin, a natural protein that stores iron atoms in the body, studded with many copies of the SARS-CoV-2 receptor-binding domain. It has been long known that many copies of an antigen in a single vaccine particle elicit a stronger immune response than a single copy does. The Institute is cagey about releasing details of its progress until its clinical trial data has been published. However, in December, the team published results showing that the ferritin vaccine confers good protection in macaque in macaque monkeys not only against the ancestral form of SARS-CoV-2, but also against the alpha, beta, gamma and delta variants and the original SARS virus. Barton Haynes of the Duke University School of Medicine in North Carolina is taking a similar approach with receptor-binding domains, studded ferritin-based nanoparticles. Last May, he and his co-workers reported a candidate vaccine that protected macaques against SARS-CoV-2, SARS, and some SARS-like bat coronaviruses. Very recently, they showed that it generates a good immune response against the Delta and the Omicron variants as well. Barton Haynes says they hope to start human clinical trials in the end of 2022. If they work out, he thinks, it might take a year or two before the vaccine is ready for use, depending on whether it's deemed different enough from those we have already to warrant another large-scale Phase 3 clinical trial before being approved. These efforts might yield a vaccine resistant to all SARS-CoV-2 variants, but in principle, such approaches might have an even wider scope, offering the universal coronavirus vaccines that researchers have called for. Barton Haynes says that would probably entail finding the crucial receptor-binding domains for other families and adding those onto the particles too. That's the beauty of the nanoparticle approach. It can readily incorporate a variety of protein fragments into a so-called multivalent vaccine. Finding the right protein fragments could mean combing through the thousands of coronaviruses known to infect wild animals such as bats, civet cats and raccoon dogs, as well as the four coronaviruses already endemic in human populations and which cause mild cold-like respiratory symptoms. It would be a huge task, but now we know the awful dangers such coronaviruses, which include those that cause outbreaks of SARS in 2003, and MERS in 2012 pose, the investment would be cheap compared to the economic and social harm it might prevent. Barton Haynes hopes it might ultimately be possible for a single jab to protect against all coronaviruses for up to 5 to 10 years. Of course, no one can be sure what the fiendishly ingenious COVID-19 virus has in store for the future. Larry Corey says the first axiom of infectious diseases: never underestimate your pathogen. The rapidity with which we've got four major variants in 2.5 years is unprecedented and surprising. One wouldn't bet against this virus. But even viruses have limits. For example, despite Omicron's extensive set of mutations, Vir's sotrovimab still works against it. Skip Virgin, Chief Scientific Officer of San Francisco-based Vir Biotechnologies, which is working with GlaxoSmithKline on vaccine development, says viruses can change some things but have a really hard time changing others. There are some things a virus just can't get away with changing. If you can find them, you're in business. He says, I'm optimistic that we can generate a vaccine that will give truly broad protection.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.